Good evening. Welcome to the Solaria Report. Today is August 11th, 2016. I'm Catherine Austin Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join me this evening. Our theme tonight is productivity declines for the third straight quarter. This is really big, major headlines. U.S. non-farm productivity declined 0.5% this quarter, so that means it's down 3 consecutive quarters. That's the longest negative stretch since 1979. The Bureau of Labor Statistics calculates labor productivity, and technically it's output per hour. So you divide an index of output by an index of hours worked for all people, including employees, proprietors, and unpaid family workers. Of course, the problem with all of these statistics is there's been so much manipulation, including of the labor statistics, that all you have to do is overstate employment by a lot, and you get a significant cut in productivity. Mish Shedlock said, read you what he wrote. Economists debate why productivity is so weak, but I propose cheap money. By holding rates so low, the Fed induced a proliferation of stores that have to be stocked and manned. Overall sales may be up, but it is spread around on a number of stores, rising faster than necessary. Unit labor costs are up thanks to new minimum wage jobs. Higher minimum wages will eventually slow store expansion. Yellen will not like the result. My guess is it's up even more on cooking the labor statistics. What if the productivity stats are cooked, whether because they're cooking the labor statistics or they want to cook productivity? I think productivity is going to be used as an excuse to re-engineer the federal budget and Social Security against the interests of labor and taxpayers, and we're all going to blame the productivity instead of the financial coup d'etat. Productivity is going to be air cover for why we have to do all these terrible things. But it could be used in other ways. It could be used to justify the fact that corporations need to bring their cash home so they can reinvest in ways that are going to make labor more productive. I'll publish the big theme on the second quarter wrap-up sometime next week. And so see more. I continue to talk a lot about productivity. The big issue is integrated economy-wide. Once you integrate the U.S. federal budget and government budgets, what you're seeing is productivity hammered by a number of things. Let's just go over them quickly. Centralization and the desire to control tightly centrally and to produce secret money, what I call the dividend harvest. You're basically using government money and government debt to run a big control machinery that's far from economic. People would be much more productive without that kind of centralized control. The software industry and systems, unfortunately, have been used way too much to facilitate that centralized control instead of to create productivity. And you see people from Silicon Valley saying, you know, why is all this innovation not creating more productivity? Well, because it's not designed to. It's designed to produce more control. The debt growth model. I just wrote a piece that I published this week on the website. It's called Meditations on a Falling U.S. Home Ownership Rate. And it's talking about what happens when you get an entire establishment who is absolutely committed to generating, you know, fees for their friends and themselves by doing things that have a negative economic return, but using government money to make it possible. And you end up with what I call a really high friction economy. A high friction economy is where it is impossible to get anything done. You're dealing with so much regulation, so much compliance, so much rules, so much complexity, and so many tired people. I keep coming back, and I'm going to keep coming back to this issue of we're at the end of the debt growth model, because we've spent 70 years, not just in the United States, but in the G7, moving away from fundamental economics, again, financed with this long-term bull in the bond market. And it's a long time to learn the wrong things in the wrong place and the wrong habits. Imagine being free to ignore markets for 70 years, and now suddenly markets are relevant again. Ba-boom, or they're about to become relevant again. Millions of people who think they're productive are not. They're working hard and behaving individually in ways they believe are productive. The problem is they're part of something that's pumped up with government contracts and purchases and has a negative return on investment. If you want to understand more of what I mean, take a look at the meditations on the falling U.S. home ownership rate. I give a case study using my home and the home of the former chairman of Dillon Reed as an example. Anyway, I'm going to keep bringing this up because this is an enormous change and it's global. Money and markets. The U.S. dollar index is at 95.84, so we're down about 2.94% for the year. Fixed income has softened a little bit, but really still a remarkable performance. The long Treasury ETF up 16.78%, the intermediate Treasury ETF up 7.14%, the bond aggregate ETF up 5.46%, and my old friend, I just don't understand why anybody would invest, the junk ETF up 11.45%. We saw Spanish sovereign bonds this week go through 1%. Can you imagine? But that's what happens when the UK and the ECB, when the Bank of England and the ECB Bank are buying major buying programs for bonds. We saw the UK go out for bonds and not be able to get enough, so they couldn't get their offering filled. Equities, the S&P now up 8.36% for the year. Earnings have been very disappointing, but the bull just keeps charging ahead, and all indications are the bull market in equities is very intact. Home builders in the U.S. now up 6.12%. Whether that can last or not, who knows? First-time homebuyers are not coming in significant efforts, in significant amounts, despite all the efforts to pump up the market for the election. So, the fundamentals are not working there. But it's harder to cook the stats on first-time home building than it is on labor. And again, it's part of what I discuss in the commentary I wrote this week, Meditations on the Falling U.S. Home Ownership Rate. Europe now moving up. The European ETF, VGK, is now in the black for the year. It's up 0.880, so it's 0.88%. So Germany now up 3.76%. The developed markets minus North America up 2.47%. Large caps, China up 5.72%. The small caps still in the red, negative 1%. And the emerging market ETF up 17.78%. Pretty glorious. So all we need are China small caps to go in the black, and we're pretty much in the black globally. Commodities, this CRB index up 3.24%. Gold holding at 25.38%. Silver 43.75%. The trend lines look good today, but we had several people important in that market come out and call for a softening. I'm curious to see what Rambus is going to say this weekend. Oil is down 12.36. That's a little bit of improvement, despite the fact headlines today that the Saudis are at record output. Coming up, a G20 meeting in China in September, and all sorts of notes and signals in preparation for it of everybody making nice with Putin. It's very interesting. Theresa May, the new prime minister of the UK, indicating she will be meeting with Putin at the G20. Russia is now saying they want to have a side meeting with Germany, France, and the Ukraine. On the Ukraine situation, no discussion of including the United States. Putin just met again with Erdogan, so they're, trying to bury the hatchet, if you will, between Russia and Turkey. Hard to do given Turkey's shoot down of a Russian pilot, but these are all very important signals that we have across Europe an effort to backpedal on the neocon agenda with Russia. Dr. Farrell did a very interesting vid chat on the Turkish coup, and I posted it up on the website for you to take a look at. I also wrote this week a response to 50 GOP national security officials who wrote a letter opposing Trump, and I want to read it to you now, and I want to make clear I am in no circumstances am I writing this as a promoter of Trump. Let me read it and then I'll explain to you why I did it. Ladies and gentlemen, your statement regarding Donald Trump's character, values, and experience leaves me deeply concerned. Clearly, the presidency of the United States is not an entry-level position. However, the disassociation of the Republican establishment from reality and from respect for the most basic human rights of the American people has left many Republicans with no other choice but a brash outsider. The Clinton administration missed $4 trillion, engineered a housing bubble that grew into trillions of dollars in mortgage fraud, and instituted private slave labor camps that skyrocketed the U.S. to the most imprisoned population in the world. The George W. Bush presidency spent $4 trillion for Middle Eastern wars and outsourced our nuclear laboratory and weapons infrastructure to a private business controlled by a private family whose management was described by a senior Lawrence Livermore employee as a combination of, quote, the worst aspects of the Department of Motor Vehicles and Goldman Sachs, quote. The Obama administration finished us off with $27 trillion of bailouts and participation in a global quantitative easing that is debasing our retirement savings. This was the result of the leadership of one or more people you consider to have, quote, character, values, and experience to be president of the United States. Why would we want more of that? Then I lay out a series of bullets. Bullet: the life expectancy of a woman my age without a high school degree has fallen by 5 years since 1990. Bullet: our children are being targeted by heavy vaccine schedules. Current predictions are that one out of every two American children will be autistic by 2030. Bullet: mandates for healthcare insurance we do not want and Common Core testing that is destroying our children's education are dictated by Washington. Bullet: state efforts to ensure transparency regarding the quality of food we eat are overruled by Washington. Okay, now listen carefully to the next bullet. Bullet: NBC ran a perfectly serious news spot recently arguing that we should microchip our children as if they were livestock. Bullet: the homeownership rate is now at its lowest point since 1965. Bullet: the employment statistics are completely cooked. Bullet: our children are overwhelmed with student debt issued under conditions of entrapment and predatory lending approved and financed by Washington. Your profound disassociation from the pain within America is inexplicable. What you consider to be reasonable and respectable is psychopathy. Donald Trump's popularity comes from his willingness to have a forthright conversation about what is happening and what needs to be done to make America great again. The debt growth model is over. There is no more cheap money to fund false realities and unproductive behavior, whether by the general population or the establishment. Breaking this trance of disassociation between reality and the official narrative is an essential first step to practical solutions. Trump is the only person proposing to break the trance. If you want to provide an alternative to Donald Trump, you must break the trance, yours included. Sincerely, Catherine Austin Fitz, The Salary Report, Assistant Secretary of Housing, Federal Housing Commissioner Bush 1. So what's going on here? The U.S. establishment is in real trouble. They are scattered. There does not appear to be internal leadership. And partly that's because it's safer at the periphery. Everybody's grabbing their money and running as part of what's happening. I think part of what's happening is the mind control technology, the entrainment, the subliminal programming has been so effective at creating a false field that they're literally forgetting what reality is, including the reality globally that they have to deal with. In part, they could be blinded by the beauty of their weapons. If you look at what they've been doing with secret weapons on disaster capitalism, it's made them a fortune and gotten them pretty far. Those weapons can't take them the whole distance, and I don't think they understand. Think they understand the extent of the backlash that's happening. To a certain extent, one of the allegations is they've made deals with Mr. Global, which are outside the national law, but they can't backtrack on them. And finally, now that the debt growth model is over, Mr. Global needs a very different kind of establishment, and frankly, a much smaller one. So. One of my questions is part of the deal to have Clinton significantly, engineer the flip? And again, the labor statistics are seriously cooked and they don't have a plan as to what to do about it. And given that the debt growth model is over, they're pinched for the resources. Carlos Slim in Mexico just came out and proposed a 3-day work week, which actually is a very good idea. You ought to take a look at it. I put the article about it, or you can just pick it up on a search. So we have an establishment that literally is in a trance, and they get upset every time that Donald Trump starts to break the trance. But the reality is all solutions require breaking the trance. And I think many people who you would never expect to support Trump are supporting him because that's their only choice to break the trance. You've got to have an honest conversation about what in the world is going on, who's really running things, and what are we going to do about it. And frankly, if Trump just breaks the trance, because the reality is every one of us has got to change, and it's going to take individual action of 325 million people, one person at a time. But that it's most individuals are frozen without an honest conversation. And if someone running for office can just break the trance and we can start having an honest conversation, that's a very, very important step. A lot of people getting ready to go back to school, or their kids are getting their grandkids ready to go back to school. Some recommended reading. I put up my foreword to Dr. Farrell's new book, Rotten to the Common Core. It's about Common Core. I wrote the foreword. Here's what I say, and I strongly recommend you read it. It's, if I must say so, it's very good. Your children or your grandchildren or your nieces and nephews are no longer safe in public schools. I explain it in that foreword exactly why. It's likely to deteriorate from here on out. What you need in a school is you need your kids offline. The online systems are not safe. They've got lots of entrainment and mind control technology. You need local control and supervision. You need to make sure that local teachers and local principals are in charge, know what's going on, and have a say. And you need minimal testing. The last thing you need is your kids tortured all week and all month, you know, by tests, and the teacher's time wasted by tests. So I'm not saying that every public school that you might put your child or grandchild into is, can't meet those standards, but the deterioration, unless we have a radical change, is pretty significant. And interestingly enough, Trump said he was for local control of schools, and he thought Common Core was rotten. So it's possible a Republican administration might change things. But what we really need is for the states to backpedal. On my local elections, I voted for a replacement to, I voted against the incumbent in my state legislature, just because I wanted, my current representative was chairman of the educational committee and really had supported Common Core. So take a look at the book review, Rotten to the Common Core. Science and technology, unfortunately, we have more psychopathy. It's not just NBC promoting microchips in your children, but we have the National Institute of Health agreeing that researchers can combine human DNA with animal DNA to create a crossbred embryo for the purpose of creating tests. Now, this has been highlighted on the internet saying crossbreeding humans with animals approved in the U.S., and various people have said, no, it's not crossbreeding. It's just combining DNA for the purpose of creating embryos to do tests. But frankly, in my opinion, that is crossbreeding. Anyway, you're seeing animal DNA and human being DNA being combined. I think that is exceptionally dangerous. You are also seeing genetically modified mosquitoes now approved to be released in areas where the so-called Zika virus exists. And all I can tell you is if you're in one of those areas, you need to do everything possible to make sure your immune system is strong. And if you can do everything possible to avoid mosquitoes, God knows what happens if you get bit by one of those mosquitoes. I don't really want to think about it, but very dangerous. Julian Assange is fighting for his life. He's been living in the Ecuadorian embassy in London for, I believe, four and a half years. WikiLeaks has had a round of new leaks, one right before at the beginning of the DNC convention on the shenanigans at the DNC, basically rigging the election or doing what they could to rig the election for Hillary Clinton. It came right after a DNC staffer was assassinated in the middle of the night in Washington walking down the street. The press has tried to spin it as a robbery, except his watch wasn't taken. His wallet wasn't taken. WikiLeaks is always very careful never to describe who their whistleblowers are, who their leakers are. However, Assange recently offered, or WikiLeaks offered, a $20,000 reward for information leading to the arrest of the DNC staffer's assassin. Well, of course, that set off all sorts of bells and whistles. Ecuador was heavily lobbied, and finally Ecuador said Julian Assange can be questioned by Swedish investigators over the rape claim. I see that as very heavy pressure by the Americans to try and corner Assange. I believe he's in serious danger if he goes back to Sweden and then somehow can be extradited to the United States. Why is this happening? WikiLeaks has said they have another dump of emails related to Hillary Clinton's server. My expectation is what those emails are going to show is that the mess in Benghazi would indicate that the U.S. was supplying weapons into Syria, essentially to ISIS, and the folks at the consulate died because the U.S. wanted to avoid exposing that operation. Once you get Donald Trump running around saying that Hillary Clinton had supplied weapons to ISIS, it's a very different picture. So the pressure is on now. My guess is that the DNC staffer was assassinated essentially by the Clinton syndicate. And Assange is going hot and heavy at the single most important control technique there is, and that is the ability to kill with impunity. If you look at the rise of the Clintons or the Bushes of various groups, the greatest power that they have is the ability to kill with impunity. You take away that weapon, and their power drops precipitously. Now, assassination, harassment, poisoning, all these different things are far from their only tactics. So I'm not saying that this is, 100% of the control game, but this is really at the heart of the matter. And so for Assange to call them on this is a very courageous and remarkable act. And so what we're watching is a little bit, from a political standpoint, a fight to the death between the Clintons and Julian Assange. And I think that every person on the planet has skin in this game, because until and unless we can create a system where crime that pays, or I say crime that pays is crime that stays. And for crime to pay, you've got to have that ability to kill with impunity. So he's looking to take a very powerful tool away. And I think that's wonderful, because if we can simply hold people accountable in the court of popular opinion for these kind of covert actions, boy, it's a new day. It would be a wonderful thing. So I would ask that you pray for Julian Assange. I'm gonna make sure we make a donation to WikiLeaks. And I think anything you can do to make it clear to the Ecuadorians and the Americans and the Swedes that you want to see Assange protected and safe and sound at the Ecuadorian embassy, certainly, frankly, I think he should be free. Okay, ask Catherine many more questions. First of all, thanks for the great links. Keep them coming. Hi, Catherine. I was going through and rereading your pre-second quarter wrap-up items and ran across your posting. The posting was called To My Fellow Citizens. I wanted to let you know that reading your words brought tears to my eyes, not only due to your signature of rock, solid, foundational comments born of wading through the muck and mire to expose the underlying truths, but mostly I think the tears were in response to the hopelessness one can feel almost palatable in the air we breathe in the U.S. middle class these days. So my question to you is, As a moral question, how does one turn it off? How do we turn off the moderate terrorists, the chem weapons being used on the civilian populations, the debasements of our civil rights, asset forfeiture and confiscation by our police departments unlawfully, and more? How do we learn to protect ourselves when we haven't been able to protect ourselves? Who was it who said it's always darkest before the dawn? Well, knowing how dark it is now, in my opinion, I think it would get a whole lot darker before we begin to see dawn's early light. How do you wade through it all while keeping your sensibility and your perspective? How do you seem to keep the key to grounding your emotions while everything about you seems in such upheaval? I think, you know, my feeling is we're going through a dark age. Now it's a high-tech dark age. I find prayer and faith are absolutely essential. And particularly if you have a spiritual approach to things, then you understand you just need to focus on what's being asked of you and turn the rest over. What Christians would say is we turn the rest over to God. I think it is very important to get a good night's sleep and to spend as much time, if not more, looking at the positive than you do at the negative. I know people who are doing a great job without spiritual practice. I don't know how they do it, but I would describe them as people with very strong faith, faith in life, faith in the human race, faith in themselves. They believe they have the power to create the world, and they take responsibility. So you're responsible to make sure that you get enough fun and wonderful things and good health and positive. So you've got to schedule it accordingly. Hi, Catherine. And then it's some wonderful person who sent me a whole bunch of stuff. A different subscriber and I were discussing international living and made some great comments on the website. And so someone else wrote in. Let me just read one section. Instead of buying a $250,000 house in America and being grateful, these expats are motivated to either build a $300,000 luxury home or buy a $200,000 luxury condo, all in a fantasy resort setting, but quite often just a mile away from third world roads, crime, etc. The entrainment is so deep. Yeah, I talk about it next week with John Rappaport, the away fantasy. If we just move away, it'll all be fine. Not to say that there aren't some wonderful places with lower costs and better health care. There are, but I think you have to be, John and I discuss it a little bit, you have to be very careful. And I should probably do a Salieri report on a more balanced approach to thinking about away. Dear Catherine, we heard you're coming through Santa Fe. That's true. I'm coming through at the end of this month. I hope you have time to attend the opera. We experienced John Giovanni last night and had a wonderful time, from the rainbows before it began, the amazing sunset sky behind the stage, and the singing, which was top-notch. Yes, I will be seeing John Giovanni. I'm very excited about that. So now, having heard your report, I can't wait. Okay, the next subscriber wrote in and wrote a very long question about mortgage fraud, which I'm not going to read the whole thing. Here's what I would say. I would say that if you try and hire a lawyer to deal with a complex and risky situation like this, it tends to be very risky and expensive for the attorney to take on, which is why in these kinds of situations, I prefer seeing somebody represent themselves pro se, but hiring the lawyer as a consultant to advise you on how to be effective at doing that and to help you navigate the law. So by turning the lawyer into a consultant, not somebody who has to represent you in front of the bar, you dramatically reduce their risks, and basically you're paying them to make you smart. Now, if you can't do it pro se, if you really believe that the only way you can get the judge to listen to you is to have somebody represent you, then I would make sure that you significantly research somebody's recommendations. The way I handled this problem was I ended up with two attorneys, or three attorneys. I had the attorneys on the litigation representing me in front of the bar. I had a general counsel educating me and checking on them and asking questions of them. And then another attorney who was an expert in insurance law, checking on the insurance company, was trying to manipulate them. It was really funny. We had a lot of redundancy, and of course it was very expensive. But, you know, when there is transparency among multiple redundant lawyers, it stops a lot of games from happening. I appreciate how difficult what you're doing is, but I think persistence really does help. And you need to be sympathetic to the lawyers, because if you look at how the bar operates and the judges operate, they can have very, very significant risk. Okay, new question. Hello, Catherine. I first want to say thank you for your tremendous courage and persistence in getting the word out. Prior to finding you, I knew my world had been flipped upside down, but I didn't know who or why they had done it. Now I do, and I have you and your many wonderful guests to thank for it. Well, I'm glad we helped. Remember, we're still searching for answers. The reason why I'm writing is that I can't seem to find a way to get myself and my family financially free and continue in an up-and-down cycle of feast or famine. I left public education back in 2007 to get away from what I saw as a corrupt system. I've been working as a construction manager since leaving, and there have been some good years and some bad years. Currently, I'm in the midst of a bad year and looking to start something that could provide a measure of independence as well as some economic security for myself and my family. I know my situation is not unique, but it is difficult to find people of similar education, age, I'm 53, and background who have found themselves unemployed, found a way through, and are willing to share how they managed to do that. Kind of like your Will Smith experience. Do you know anyone else this has happened to? Yes, but nobody white. I love that story. Anyway, this feels a little like that. Ultimately, I believe that once I've found a way to get through this, the Lord will provide opportunities for me to help others do the same in the future. So once again, thank you for all you're doing, and I will continue to pray that the Lord keeps his hand of protection on you and continues to bless you in all that you do. Well, I appreciate that. Let me just give a couple of comments. My current business has evolved out of helping people who wanted my help. I just started responding to people who needed me. It had nothing to do, I didn't charge the money. I was just, they were asking me questions. I was trying to answer the questions. They were asking for what they should do in their situation, and I just go research and try and figure it out with them. It was very organic. It went on for years until it evolved into a business, and really into two businesses. One of the things I discovered, it was essential that I constantly learn new skills as I was going, including skills. I had to learn to do much more for myself. And it was really funny. I remember my homes were always beautifully cleaned. I always had lots of staff keeping them spotless. And of course, I discovered that if I had to work on litigation for 16 hours a day, there was no time to keep my house clean. So I realized I had to stack functions. And so I got a headset and figured out how I could clean nonstop all day long while I was on the phone with attorneys and working on litigation. So literally, if somebody comes over to my house to say hello, I literally can't sit still and talk to them. I have to have them talking while I'm cleaning. Reminds me of Golda Meir. Somebody told a story of going to Golda Meir's house to talk to her about, you know, some major international treaty, and she kept insisting on cleaning the house and cooking while they were talking. I said, well, there you go. You want to get associated with critical local issues. It depends on where you live, but a lot of income or opportunities can flow out of helping people with their problems. One thing is there an opportunity to organize a buying club by going to the terminal market, taking turns going to the terminal market, and getting really good food at wholesale prices? I think there's going to be a lot of opportunities in and around food. Another is liquidation, estate and business liquidation. When you go through periods of these dramatic changes, I just talked to an entrepreneur today who's got a growing business handling auctions and liquidations in their community, different community than yours, but I think those are going to be accelerating. Is there a chamber or rotary or other civic or church institution who's worth helping, where if you get in, do a good job, you can build it into network, you can build it into income? Is there local barter networks or are there local farmer markets, places that are creating local liquidity? It's very important to stay very busy, and learning in the direction of is providing important needs. So obviously it depends on what your skills are, what you're interested in. It's also critical to have a positive vision of where you're going. You have to be useful, and you have to have a vision of yourself being very, very useful. And I think that's the hardest thing to do. It's so easy to get discouraged when the economy is changing and you feel like things aren't working and your cash flow and assets are very, very pinched. I know a lot of people who stepped into a place where there was no job or income, but they have helped the group or the organization or the entrepreneur build a cash flow and then work their way into an income flow by getting that cash flow up. And so I really encourage you to look for opportunities to do that. Everybody needs to be an entrepreneur these days. Anyway, so as I said, your enemy is discouragement. You have to believe you're headed to a better place. I have a commentary I wrote called Turtle Forth, and if you haven't read it, I would really encourage you to do so. We got a request to post a GoFundMe. A daughter of I believe FDNY is the fire department of New York, was murdered, and they're collecting money for a higher reward to bring forth people who know something about it. Anyway, so Salieri made a small d donation and posted it, and I recommend it to you. I'm a great believer in making lots of donations, even if they're small. I was always amazed during the litigation how I'd go into the black churches and an old church mother heard my story would come up and say, "Darling, I really hope this blesses you." And she'd put a quarter or a dollar bill in my hand, and it was remarkable because a dollar bill or a quarter is a prayer, and it's at the heart of liquidity. And it was amazing. The white people wouldn't. White people were amazing. They were just like, "Well, you got to go get a job." But there's an enormous. It's almost like we've been trained not to provide liquidity outside the tapeworm. But the whole key to real solutions is, in fact, creating liquidity outside a tapeworm, and that's one of the reasons I like the idea of crowdfunding, because the more we can circulate to each other and make things go in a way that's economic, the faster we can really rock and roll. As I said, the current wealth is less than 1% of what it could be, and that's because, the liquidity is all locked into the control system. Dear Catherine, thanks for all your powerful insight. Question number one. I've heard that we owe part of the national debt to the Federal Reserve. Hold on just a second. Which prints up our money supply as a loan at interest. If this is true, what is the interest rate on that loan? The Treasury prints the currency, and then the Fed distributes it, the cash by selling it to the banks. So if you're talking about pure currency. But then it also makes loans at the Fed window and it buys bonds at various interest rates. So it's not one interest rate, it's various interest rates depending on what the markets are. And that's coming down. The profits on that operation go back to the Treasury. So the Fed, after expenses, generates, well, the banks, the 12 banks, the local banks, generate money for their shareholders, but the profits are supposed to go back, a big dividend go to Treasury. The real question is what gets skimmed through the back door, not just money, but intelligence. Because frankly, the greatest thing that the Fed has of value is their data. The data is worth infinitely more, and the intelligence is worth infinitely more than the money. So don't just focus on the money. Again, if true, what percentage of the national debt do we owe to countries like China, and what percentage do we owe to the Federal Reserve? Okay, so let me go through the official statistics, but before I do, I just want to make a caveat. I believe that the debt is much larger than what the official numbers show. I think a lot of debt has been issued off balance sheet and not disclosed. I think that's one of the reasons that several buildings came down on 9/11 was to tear up records associated with that larger amount of debt. When the federal government has refused to comply with the law for 20 years regarding audited financial statements, and when a institution refuses to produce audited financial statements for 20 years, you should not trust their numbers. So with that caveat, we have on the books $19 trillion of debt, $5 trillion is intergovernmental. And that's essentially owed to 230 other federal agencies. The mother load there is basically retirement funds. It's 2.8 trillion in the Social Security fund, 873 billion in the OPM retirement fund, 601 billion in the military retirement fund, and then we have 267 billion in the Medicare and supplementary medical insurance trust fund, and then all other retirement funds have another 187 billion, and then there's cash on hand to fund federal government operations of a half a trillion. And so of the 19, 5 trillion is essentially, or about 25%, intergovernmental. The rest is debt held by the public. Of that, about 32% is held by foreign countries, foreign institutions. The Federal Reserve holds 2.5 trillion. Mutual funds hold another trillion. State and local and private pension funds hold another 1.2 trillion, and banks hold another half a trillion. Insurance companies about 300 billion, then the U.S. savings bonds, presumably individuals, et cetera, 174 billion. So as you can see, the majority holders are basically the American people, because it's our retirement systems, whether in the federal government or in pension funds, or we save through our brokerage firms and mutual funds, or insurance companies with annuities. You and I are the people holding this paper, not China. Although certainly if foreign nations and institutions have 32%, that's not necessarily small potatoes. That's $6 trillion. What are some good sources? Question two, what are some good sources to read up on hedged equity and the companies that provide it to ordinary investors? I can't make recommendations on the Solaria investment on Solaria report, because I don't do investment advice, and so I'm not trying to steer you to any particular company. Just be careful when you talk about hedged equity. It's hedged with a D, HEDGED. That has nothing to do with hedge funds. A hedge fund is an actively managed fund that uses leverage. Hedged equity is a portfolio, usually actively managed, that buys hedges to protect you against a fall in the market. You'll sometimes see mutual funds that r are running a hedged equity portfolio called long short funds, because they have they're long, but they have basically a protection again on the short side. So you'll have to look down and look. What you're looking for is somebody who's fully invested in the equity markets, but then is putting on a hedge, so that if the market goes up, they don't go up as much because their hedge will be losing value. But if the market goes down, you have a floor underneath you. So when you look at these, you need to study their performance track record, and you need to make, because you need not only the hedge to work, but you need their stock picking to also work. And you can see funds that have good performance and funds that don't. Again, when the market's up, they should be lagging. When the market's down, they should be significantly superior in their performance. So I hope that helps you. If you just do a search for hedged equity or long short, you should be able to, especially if you go to sites that track a lot of the different funds, including Morningstar. Let's go to the movies. I'd love to use the movie, but it's not out yet. I used a trailer for a new movie about engineers that was financed by Bechtel, called Dream Big. It's going to be published in 2017, and it's really targeted at encouraging young people to get interested in engineering. I think it's going to be very, very good. So I'm a big believer in the importance of being good at making things. I believe it's absolutely essential to a successful civilization. And we've been in a software boom in the United States for the last umpty-ump years, and now we're going into a real hardware boom. And hardware is going to get sexy. It's where it's at. So including rebuilding infrastructure, I think there's going to be a real push after the election for infrastructure, whether it's the Republican or Democrats. I mentioned again two two documentaries that I love that I've recommended before in Let's Go to the Movies, The Seven Wonders of the Industrial World, produced by the BBC, including the story in that of Bechtel's building of the Hoover Dam, which is a remarkable story, and then Engineering an Empire by the History Channel. And you begin to understand that creating productivity in a society really requires great infrastructure, and the better you get really effective, efficient infrastructure investment, the more productive you can make a society. And it really can be a break or make issue. Which brings us to the interview with a wonderful Sally Denton, who has just written a marvelous book about Bechtel. And so she joins us to discuss Bechtel. Bechtel is the perfect example of a company that is the kind of company we need to have a positive total return. So we all know the old expression, what's good for General Motors is good for America. If we're gonna make America great, then we need the companies that have the real talent and intellectual capital to be part of making America great again. And if you look at what Bechtel's been up to for the last 10 or 20 years, if you look at the stories that Denton tells us about their participation in Iraq, their participation with the nuclear wars, unfortunately, they've been making money on America's negative total return. So what's good for Bechtel is bad for America. You can't let that happen if things are going to work. So one of the most important questions is, how do we turn that around? So we need to turn it around for every person. We need to turn it around for every household. We need to turn it around for every company. But certainly the companies that have the greatest engineering skills and talent, you absolutely need them to turn around. And so I thought it was a very interesting time, given the focus we've had on productivity and how do we make America great again, to ask that question about Bechtel. And Denton does a marvelous job of sort of teeing up those issues. And Denton points out that there's a new younger generation of family leadership at Bechtel. And so maybe that's an opportunity. I never give up hope. So Bechtel is clearly a company that has engineered unbelievably miraculous and amazing creations. As I said, the Hoover Dam is one of the most famous, but really they've been responsible for a long list of other engineering wonders all around the world. And it would be a horrible thing. I use a quote from Stephen D. Bechtel at the top of the interview when he said, we're more about making money than making things. We can't be like that. We need to be about making great things. And if we do it right, we make money. But I think we've gotten things upside down. And if we're going to get back to having an economy that doesn't work off of gobs of government debt, but off of equity, then we need to be about making wonderful things and doing it on an economically sustainable basis. Well, that's it for tonight. In closing, next week we're going to be talking human communications between reality and official reality with John Rappaport. This is an explosive problem. I cannot tell you how many questions I'm getting from subscribers. How do I talk to people who are completely mind controlled? How do I talk to people who are in the trance? How do I talk to people who are scared and don't want to talk about reality? How do I talk about people who know the official reality is about a bunch of bunk, but have gotten lost in these new fake alternative realities? You know, they're addicted to fear porn and now I can't talk sense to them. So John and I begin to explore this conversation. It's this, like productivity, is going to go on for a long time because, you know, coming out of the trance is part of what we need to get productive. And that trance is very, very deep. I quoted last week, Simon Parks was giving a lecture and somebody asked him about depopulation. He said, no, I'm not worried about depopulation now that the mind control technology has been so effective. The leadership doesn't feel like they need depopulation. It was almost scary. But this question about how to be effective and communicate across divergent realities is going to be with us for a while. So John and I took a crack at it this week, and I think you'll enjoy it. Then August 25th, an unbelievably special interview with Pioneering, called Pioneering Urban Farms, with Will Allen, remarkable, very successful athlete and executive at Procter & Gamble, who decided to start an urban farm, has really proven a for-profit model that I think can work and go on scale. Remarkable and unbelievably inspiring man. I'm very happy that Harry decided to do that. And then September 1st, Franklin Sanders is going to join us with Precious Metals. Clearly what's been happening, Precious Metals have been rocking and rolling all year. The question, is the bull market reasserting? Has it reasserted? What's ahead for Precious Metals? So until next week with John Rappaport, please remember, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, then you need to start one. Ladies and gentlemen, good night and good luck.